Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Okay, the fourth book in the phenomenally successful Thursday Murder Club series is out. It's called The Last Devil to Die, and I can confirm a lot of people do die in it. And I'm delighted to say its author Richard Osman joins me now. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Hey, Brendan, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Richard, can we take a moment first to acknowledge this incredible success? So I was reading, in 2 years, the Thursday Murder Club books have sold 5 million in the UK alone. You've sold 200,000 in Ireland. I was wondering, do you still feel like a fraud, or do you now kind of accept you're a writer?
That's a really good question. Do any of us ever stop feeling like a fraud in any of our jobs, Brendan? I don't think we do. I certainly my daily routine tells me I'm a writer now. You know, I do very little TV. I'm essentially sort of get up, write, kill a few people, have lunch, and then kill a few more people. So I'm sort of exactly the same amount of a fraud as every other writer is, I think.
Yeah, I think the real test is when you meet other writers. Do you think, oh, these people are all proper writers, and I'm just a chancer here?
Well, do you know what I do? But then you say to them. You say to, you know, you meet someone like Ian Rankin or someone like that, and you say, but Ian, when you meet other writers, do you think you're a fraud? He goes, yeah, of course. And of course I do. Yeah. I interviewed Stephen King, and I was saying, yeah, but, you know, like, what's it like to be Stephen King? He's like, oh, just sort of terrible. Every time I pick up a pen, I'm like, oh, no, this one, I've lost it. This is the one. So you sort of just have to get on with it, don't you?
Yeah. It is kind of depressing to think, though, that even if you become Stephen King, there's still no respite from the self and the doubting voices, isn't it?
But I think that's why we do a good job, right? I think that's why people turn up. I think every day you go into work, if you think, oh, this is the day they're going to find me out, or this is the day I've really got to impress. That's the drive, I think. I think the moment you lose that, it's probably time to retire.
Yeah. God, see, people think, oh, I'd love to be a writer. But then when you put it like that, it just sounds like a constant running away from something. Anyway, listen, we're getting a bit downbeat here, but this is a success story. Explain to people what the Thursday Murder Club is, maybe.
Well, essentially, it's a series of books, and it's about four people who meet in a retirement village. We've got Joyce, who was a former nurse. We've got Elizabeth, who was a former spy. Ibrahim, who is a psychiatrist, and Ron, who was a trades union official. So four really different people. And essentially, they solve murders together. Originally, it was sort of old cold cases, and then suddenly bodies started piling up around them. So you've got four very different people, four heroes, all in their late 70s, early 80s, and big sort of Agatha Christie crime stories happening around them. And so it's plenty of murder, plenty of laughs, plenty of tears, plenty of drinking, plenty of gossip and mischief. But it's essentially a gang. And a gang in the middle of these sort of very, very golden age crime stories.
And there are a lot of great strands in the new book. There's drug dealing. There's a kind of a catfishing subplot, which is very good. But first off, can you and me agree? You obviously did some research into it, and I've now read about it in your book. No one should ever buy an antique again, should they?
Well, it's interesting. So I wanted to do a little bit. Antique shops seem so genteel and lovely, right? We've all been in them. If ever you're on holiday in a little village, you go into an antique shop. And I should say now, most antique dealers are perfectly legal, okay?
Yes.
So absolutely. Listen, let's say that from the off. However, I had a sort of plot line where I wanted antiques to be involved in forgery and art forgery. And I talked to, there's a lovely guy called Raj Bizram. He does all the antiques roadshow and stuff like that. And I said, Raj, I've got a few stories about antiques dealers. Could this happen? Could this happen? Could this happen? And he just for the next hour told me stories that were so much worse of things that happened, you know, from auction houses down to antique shops. And I mean, literally the whole system of kind of forgeries and dodginess. So, you know, it's a very good world for criminals to get involved in because it's a cash world, right?
Antique dealing. Of course.
I say, to reiterate, Brendan, for you and for me, most antique dealers are perfectly above board and legal.
Okay.
But some are not.
And we are happy to put that on the record. So listen, there's a lot of fun in the book. But like, I think what people who haven't read them mightn't realise as well is that these are kind of very poignant books about ageing and about older life and everything, which you do seem to have an extraordinary insight into. Do you spend a lot of time with older people?
You know, I spend time with my mum, and she lives in a retirement village. And, you know, my basic thing with these books is I get the joy of these characters, right, and their gang and the mischief they get up to and the lack of consequences for what they do and their invisibility, which makes them great kind of detectives. So I get all that fun, and there's a lot of laughs. But in order to have that, I have to pay the tax on that, just as we have to pay the tax on life. So I have to show frailty. I have to show grief. You know, I have to show things like dementia. I have to see them struggling with the things that are real, because if characters are just like superheroes, then there's no point having them. They have to go through difficulties. We have to believe them. And crime fiction can do that so beautifully, because while you've got the story of crime going on and a murder to solve, and, you know, your brain cells are ticking over, really you're spending time with characters and you want to love them. And to love characters, you have to believe them. And so I try and show everything that that happens in older age.
It's interesting that you said at the start there, the freedom they have, because they're kind of invisible. Like, if we were to age well, part of it is appreciating, I can do what I want now. Consequences are limited, aren't they?
Well, that's it. There's, you know, I think various characters, you know, Elizabeth, who was the former spy for her whole life, she's obviously been, you know, the Official Secrets Act has meant that she can't talk about what she's done. But now at 80, she's sort of saying, well, what are they going to do to me?
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to put me in court. They're not going to put me in prison. I'm 80. You know, it's not. They're not going to do it. And, you know, various points, people say the only people who can tell you what to do when you're 80 are your children and your doctors. Everyone else, you do it because what are people going to do? You sort of get to the age where you realize that actually most threats are sort of meaningless, and you can sort of be naughty if you want to be.
Mm. Have we written old people out of the culture and out of life a bit?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the reasons why the reactions to these books have been, you know, so big. Because, you know, that generation, you sort of get to the stage where you know the most, where you've accumulated this wisdom. You've lived through so many different generations, so many different things, so many different schemes and scams. And suddenly you've got all of this wisdom. And exactly the point where the whole of our culture says, we're not interested in you anymore. You lock yourself away. We're interested in Instagram influences. That's the thing we're interested in. We want to hear their opinion on things. And so it's weird. You go to my mum's retirement village, full of these super bright, super smart people, and no one wants to know. You know, and hopefully with the Thursday Murder Club books, people will start thinking a bit more about that's a generation that we might make a bit more use of.
Yeah, you mentioned the other aspects to their lives, the grief and everything else. Like the way the grief touches in on the book is interesting, because it's kind of a fact of life with them in a way, isn't it? Like, grief can be pretty devastating for people, but you say about the widows go to bed with ghosts every night, and it kind of, as it goes on, they're losing friends, they're losing lovers, because they have lovers, but they're losing spouses, and it's sad, but it is a fact of their lives more so, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I think, you know, when we're younger, death is impossibly tragic because it's so unlikely. And we cling very, very, very dearly to it because it's sort of unthinkable. And as you get older, even when I got to 50, you sort of work out, you go, oh, this thing about we're all going to die, that's not just something people say. That is sort of something that's going to happen. And again, I talked to my mum, and she's, you know, there's a lot of funerals going on. And so you have to make some sort of peace with it, because, you know, it's not something you can fight. It's not something you can kind of ward off. And I think as you get older, it becomes more and more real. And so I think their attitude towards it is different. And as you say, able to talk about it more plainly and more cleanly. And I think that's an interesting thing to write about.
Mm. And look, we won't give spoilers, but you do deal with dementia very powerfully in the book. I think it's important to you, and I think kind of personal to you, that theme, isn't it?
Yeah, both my grandparents had dementia of very different types. And I know so many people. I mean, it's very hard to think of a family in Ireland that hasn't been touched in some way. You know, all families have it somewhere. And it's not always talked about as much as it should be. I've written, there's a plot where Elizabeth's husband, Stephen, has had dementia since the first book, and a lot of things come to a head in this book. And yeah, I wanted to give him his humanity and his dignity, and sort of try and get inside his head a little bit. But
which was very ambitious. I thought to try and give us like a first person view of dementia, but I actually thought it was quite devastating in the sense that you portray this. There's no solid ground for him second to second, is there?
Yeah, I always remember with my grandfather who could go between two extremes so quickly, you know, from absolute despair to telling you a story about his army days and beaming with joy, and thinking about the transitions between those. And he was in my head as I was writing Stephen and just thinking about what the mind is doing there, what the mind is trying to fetch and how it's trying to do it. So that's what I tried to do. And again, it's a personal experience of it, but hopefully it resonates with some people.
Mm. Would we be spoiling things for people to tell them about Stephen's letter?
No, I think that's okay.
Yeah. We'll explain about it, because it's actually a very kind of, it's a powerful plot point there.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, there's a point where Elizabeth returns home and Stephen is reading a letter, and it's a letter that tells him that he has dementia, and Elizabeth at first is furious because she thinks someone is meddling and someone has written to Stephen and that's her business. And you know, but essentially says to him, look, you're in the early stages, but it's going to get worse, and I just want you to read this letter. And I want you to get Elizabeth to read this letter to you every day, you know, just to remind you, just so you know what's happening to you. And Elizabeth is listening to the letter and thinking, I don't want to read this to him every day. I don't want to lose this guy. And she's thinking, who has written it? Who has written it? And then it occurs to her that Stephen had written it to himself a year previously when he was slightly more lucid. He'd written it to himself and asked his solicitor to post it to him a year hence, just so he knew the truth of it. Just a letter from himself he knew would not be a lie. He knew if he looked at that, he would know the truth of what he was going through. And so, yeah, that was an interesting thing to write, and the acceptance of Elizabeth that she will read this out to him every day and him knowing it's his own words. I was crying writing it, and I bet.
I can imagine. Yeah. There's a thing in it that jumped out, which he says to himself, I send you my love, dear man, a year into the future. I love you.
Mm.
And I mean, the whole thing was, the letter was so kind of affecting anyway. But there was something about seeing a kind of, an adult, mature English man able to say to himself, I love you. I think you put that in very deliberately, I think, did you?
Yeah, I think I did. I think it's important, isn't it? Sometimes we don't love ourselves as we might. And that idea of, I always think of the decision you make now, have a little think about what you in 5 years, how you'll be impacted by it. And the conversation between yourself and future you, I think is a really interesting one. We always say, oh, I'd love to give advice to my 16-year-old self. I'd love to go back in time and give advice. Yeah. And you think, yeah, but you can travel forward in future and actually do things now for the you of 20 years' time, which is quite an interesting way of living your life.
Yeah, and to tell yourself in the future, by the way, I love you. You've mentioned your mother and her retirement village a few times, and Cooper's Chase in the book is based on your mother's retirement village, which sounds good, like a carvery on a Sunday and everything. Is your mother okay with this? Are the people in the retirement home okay with it? Do they know that you're when you're there, you're like mining them for stuff?
Yeah, they're fine with it. At first, my mum, when she read the first one, she thought it's just going to be me writing stories about her friends. And I thought, no, I'm a writer. I'm making stuff up. I love the spirit of this place, but I'm not basing it on anyone. No, you go there now, and you know, people pitch you murders. People say, I'll tell you how you could kill someone. We were down there the other day. I mean, it's quite exciting for everyone. We were down there the other day and Angela Rippon came down with us to interview my mum. And, you know, it's surreal. So because Angela Rippon was someone I grew up watching on TV with my mum. Yeah. And suddenly she's sitting on my mum's patio interviewing her. And you can see my mum, who plays it so cool. I was like, oh, she doesn't look very impressed with Angela Rippon. And when Angela Rippon went, my mum just went, oh, my God, I'm pinching myself. And I thought, well, you kept that. Tell your face, love. You kept that quiet. It's really, it's, It's lots of adventures down there. Lots of people telling me how to murder people, which is great.
Fantastic. I like the sound of your mother. She wasn't letting Angela Rippon know she was impressed. You don't impress me, Angela Rippon.
She's a primary school teacher. Nothing impresses her.
What's your theory on why the books are so successful? Is it warmth? Because they have great heart, and I suppose we are in a kind of a cynical age, aren't we?
Yeah, I think they're warm, but they're warm without being treacly, I think. I think they're, you know, because they're sort of real as well. I tell real stories, and bad stuff happens in these books. But we love the characters, and the characters seem to face forward into life the way we'd like to. So, yeah, I think warmth with truth is the thing that we really, really love, because they're warm, but then they're not a fantasy. And there's plenty of laughs in them because the characters are making us laugh the way they react to things. There are plenty of tears, and there's a mystery. So it's one of those things around the world. That seems to be a combination that people are very, very attracted to. But warmth, especially now, is something we're all lacking. And so it's lovely that the books are giving people that.
I believe it was Marion Keyes helped you find this voice you have as a writer.
Well, Marion, God bless her. I was chatting to her about something else entirely. I said, "Oh, you know, I'm going to write, and it's difficult, isn't it, writing? And how do you do it?" And she says, "Well, the main thing I do when I sit down, I light a candle, and lighting a candle tells me the bit of the day where I'm not writing is finished, and the bit of the day when I'm writing has started." I said, okay, that's interesting, because I sort of see what she meant. And then 3 days later, a little knock on the door and a postman and a candle from Marion. Now every day when I start writing, I light a candle to say, listen, you've been mucking about all morning. We light the candle. Now we get down to the serious work of writing. So, yeah, that's a lovely thing of just when you do it, it's like getting to the gym, you know, putting your trainers on. You're like, okay, that's it, I'm going. And with writing, sit your bottom down on your chair, light your candle, and okay, here we go, do a day of work.
And I was reading about you and Marion being friends and everything, and I read that you both consider yourself introverts, which I think people will understand with Marion, because I guess we know her well. People are always surprised that someone like you, a TV presenter, is an introvert. But I guess it's different to shy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's different to shy. I'm okay in front of a TV. I mean, here's the difference. In front of a TV camera, I'm all right, and I can look down the barrel of the lens and talk to people. If there's a studio audience, I'm like, oh no, oh God, this is awkward. What are they going to think of me? Or when I do a book event or something, you know, until you get your first laugh, I'm not one of those people who, like, I know lots of stand-up comedians, they go on stage and they love the acclaim and they love being in front of people, and that to me I don't like. I like being in a small group of people, and so it's the TV is fine, because by and large you don't have audiences these days, so I can just sit there and talk, and I like that. But yeah, as soon as I've got an audience, that's why I've never done stand-up or a tour or any of that kind of stuff. It's just not in my bones. I like to go home, put the snooker on and have a cup of tea.
Apart from Marion, Graham Norton, another one of, you know, TV presenter turned writer like yourself.
Yeah.
I gather he's your great rival in the Irish book charts, is he?
Oh, my goodness. Every single time, every week you get the charts from around the world. And I love all the numbers and statistics. Always love that sort of thing. And Ireland, you go, oh, he's doing great in Ireland. You go, oh, yeah, number two. And he goes, number two, is it? Yeah. What's number one? Graham Norton. It's always Graham. You always say, if everyone, number two in Ireland to me is like being number one, because it's number one except for Graham.
Yes, yes.
And the Irish book charts, I always look at them and it's great. I love how supportive Irish people are of Irish writers. Doesn't happen in lots of territories around the world, by the way. It doesn't happen in the UK either. But to me, to be a sort of cuckoo in the nest in that top 10, I always love it. I think perhaps I could be honorary Irish one day. So I love being in that top 10. I love coming over to Ireland. But I will always bow to Graham Norton.
Yeah, listen, we do love making people honorary Irish as long as they're successful. So I think you would qualify.
There you go. I'll take that.
And listen, you'll have a much, much wider audience when the Steven Spielberg film of the first book comes out. But I guess, is that delayed again now with the writers and actors strike?
Yes, it was due to be filmed this autumn, so it was all ready to go, director on board and all that kind of stuff, casting had just started. And yet now, of course, quite rightly, it's off and we shall wait again. But that's the movie business. And I knew from the second I signed up, I knew not to get my hopes up or ever think about it or ever pick out a suit for the red carpet, because the movie industry is crazy. You know, so many things can go wrong and so many things do go wrong. But at some point, I suspect, everyone still seems excited, it'll come out. All the people who shout casting to me on the street will finally see who's going to be in it. It'll be a joy. But I mean, who knows when? Films are absolutely crazy. If I'd made it for TV, it would have been out 3 years ago.
Yeah. I think if Spielberg's on board, there's a good chance it'll get made, though. I wouldn't give up hope yet.
No,
I think it's a bit of clout.
But it may be 2028 or something. Okay. By the time it does, who knows?
Yeah, and you presumably you're looking forward to having your LA period, are you? Where you know go out and hobnob around and new teeth and God, a tan mate. And a.
We've got to go to LA in a few weeks actually to do a few sort of book events and stuff like that, and it does not suit me at all. I'm writing a new series of books at the moment, and one of the heroes of it is a cop in his 50s who is forced to go abroad and just doesn't want it. All he wants to do is stay at home. All he wants to do is do his pub quiz, and he's sort of forced to travel the world. And it's slightly based on me that, you know, you fly off to LA and Australia and on all these book tours, and you're like, I'm gonna miss the Fulham match. Can I not just stay at home? So it's lovely, you know, it's nice to see those different places, but I'm not a good traveler.
And you got married in December. You assured me the last time we were speaking that there'd be no thrones at the wedding, a very, very down-home affair. How is married life? No. Is it any different?
No, it's fantastic. I mean, listen, it's as it was before, but even better, I think, because it's sort of, you can feel the permanence of the thing and, you know, you can feel you're a unit. In fact, my wife absolutely loves going to LA, so actually it's kind of perfect because, you know, I get to go to LA and, you know, with a native guide who kind of adores it. But no, it's been wonderful. In fact, this week we've sort of hired a cottage for a week just to write, because she's writing as well. So it's thus far, Brendan, it seems to be going well. Anyone on the sweepstake who had under a year would have lost their money.
Okay, well look, as long as you both keep writing, that'll give it great longevity. Just get into another room, light the candle, and there you go.
Two candles. Candle households.
Listen, you alluded there that so your next book is not going to be a Thursday Murder Club book.
No, the next one they will be coming back. So this one is not the last one for sure. But I think when people read this one, they'll agree that perhaps they need a year off for a bit of rest and recuperation. So I'll be coming back to them the year after. But yeah, I'm doing a new detective duo, who are a father-in-law and a daughter-in-law. So yeah, he's like a retired cop. He's got a small investigations agency, and she's a close protection officer who goes around the world, you know, protecting billionaires and, you know, beating people up. So real chalk and cheese, but they love each other, and she's in trouble. He then has to sort of fly out around the world, much to his chagrin. I think it's fun. I mean, that's how I'm sort of writing it at the moment, and it's weird writing different characters and having these different people.
Is it? Yeah.
Because, I mean, to me, books are the characters are the things. People always say, how do you get your plots? And actually plots, you know, there's lots of bad things in the world that you can base plots on, but characters you want to spend time with, that's harder. So at the moment, all my characters are just sort of chatting to each other, and so I'm getting to know them a little bit and seeing, you know, what I like about them and, you know, what edges I can knock off them or add to them. It's going to be a fun series, I think. There will be more Thursday Murder Club, but, you know, it'll be nice to have a Poirot to my Marple, if you will, another series of books.
Richard, before you go, we talked about self-love and that earlier. You spoke to me the last time we spoke about your food addiction, and I think a lot of people got a lot out of what you said. How are you getting on with that, or any words of wisdom for people?
Yeah, good, not bad, actually. And funnily enough, you know, I may have said last time, but lots of people come up to me on the street. I find it fascinating. And often, it's funny enough, it's wives talk to me and on behalf of their husbands, and just saying, husband saying, look, no one had really, you know, explained the thing that's you know, that's so familiar to me before, you know, this idea of food being in control of you and, you know, binge eating and this, that, the other, and the shame associated with it. And, you know, the advice I'd always give is this, that if you have food addiction issues, and some people don't believe they exist, but that's, we don't need to worry about those people. You must live your truth. If you think you have them, as I have them, and if you're living in shame about that, if it's something you hide away because you're embarrassed, or you just think, well, this is ridiculous, this is childish and, you know, absurd, tell somebody, you know, talk to somebody you trust, and actually the shame disappears very, very quickly. You know, there won't be anyone you tell who you love who goes, that's weird, what's wrong with you? Everybody would go, mate, oh yeah, you know what, I sort of knew that. Let's talk about it. And the second you start talking about it, loses so much of its power, you know, like with any addictions. And, you know, that's the start of recovery, really, is to be able to be honest with, you know, people that you love. And it's, you know, people get it. Life is hard. Everyone's got something. We're all, you know, we've all got craziness in us one way or another. And if that's yours, then, you know, talk about it. That would be my only real advice.
And is food a harder one to admit to, do you think? Because people think that's ridiculous. Don't be silly.
Yeah, and it feels kind of childish, right? Okay. And you know, a bar of dairy milk feels less sort of daredevil than a bottle of whiskey. You know, there's culturally a certain elan to alcoholism or drug addiction. Awful though they both are, and food, there is none of that. You know, it's sort of fat people and Billy Bunter and, you know, shoving cake in your mouth, and, you know, it's comic book. But the more people talk about it, the more it just becomes normal. Look, we know there's a food addiction epidemic. Look around you. I mean, it's all out there for you to see. There's lots of people who got willpower and they still can't deal with it. Right. This is not a willpower issue. This is industries have spent billions putting fat and sugar in exactly the right amounts in lots of foods and made them really cheap for us. Right. It's not rocket science. It's all out there. And so don't blame yourself. It's OK. If it's your thing, then talk to people about it. And, you know, shining a light on things is a great disinfectant.
OK. Thank you for that. Oh, listen, before you go, I know we're meant to be talking about you, but people will remember that your brother, Matt, is the bass player in Suede. And I think we mentioned him briefly. I think Autofiction had just come out when we spoke last year.
Oh, yeah.
But listen, since then, I haven't got to see them live, but I've seen them do a lot of performances and stuff. They're like teenagers, aren't they? I mean, talk about roaring back as you know, men of a certain age. Brett, I feel, is a model for all of us gracefully aging dandies, isn't he?
I mean, isn't he just? You go see him live. As we've seen him live a couple of times recently. Firstly, they are brilliant. I mean, better than ever, you know, and still releasing great music. But they look insane. They're so skinny. They're still sort of dressed all in black. And you go, these guys are in their mid-50s. Yeah. And they look absolutely incredible. It's infuriating, but no, it's great. It's lovely to see him, and he's written novel as well, which has done great business, which is lovely. But also, he's just touring the world with his mates, you know, still making good money out of this sort of rock and roll dream he had when he was 15 years old. And yeah, I couldn't be prouder and happier of him.
Okay, Thursday Murder Club: The Last Devil to Die is out now, published by Viking. Richard Osman, thank you so much.
Brendan, a pleasure as always.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.